Coming up on Path to Zero.
This is certainly in the category of small modular reactors. The idea you could build this in a factory, ship it out on the back of a truck, install it quickly, and have rapid deployment of nuclear technology.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. We've touched on nuclear energy before here on Path to Zero, but this time we're going to take a deep dive into molten salt by talking to an innovator who is heading up research that he believes will lead to safer, cleaner, and more affordable nuclear power. Dr. Rusty Towle is a physics professor at Abilene Christian University in Texas, spent time as an instructor at the Naval Nuclear Power School, and then later earned his PhD in nuclear physics at the University of Texas in Austin. Dr. Towle and his team have applied for a permit with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build the first new research reactor of any kind in the United States in more than 30 years. The groundbreaking aspect to his reactor is that it will be cooled by molten salt instead of water. And if that's successful, this $100 million project could lead to commercial success in the small modular nuclear reactor arena. Dr. Towle is the director of the NEXT Lab at Abilene Christian University, which stands for Nuclear Energy Experimental Testing. Dr. Towle, welcome to the Path to Zero. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, we're going to talk today a lot about nuclear and molten salt, but I think maybe the best place to start is just by you maybe even explaining what molten salt even is, why it's better than water. Because I think so many people cannot really understand the difference between a molten salt reactor and a traditional reactor.
You bet. So all we mean by molten salt is salt in liquid state. So typical room temperature salts that we're familiar with are all solids. But maybe it's good to make an analogy to water, which again is what we use as a coolant in a lot of things, whether it's our car or nuclear reactors. At room temperature, water is a liquid. Liquids are really good at heat transfer fluids because high heat capacity, they can move a lot of heat from point A to point B efficiently. Now, water, when it gets above 100 degrees centigrade, wants to become a vapor, and a gas is not a very good heat transfer fluid. You can't move near as much energy, thermal energy, from point A to point B with a gas. And that's why in our cars, we have antifreeze running through, basically water running through our engine to the radiator to remove that thermal energy. So what are we doing with a molten salt? We take salt, we raise the temperature up to elevate it, and it melts, and it becomes a molten salt. Now we have a fluid, so great heat transfer characteristics, but it's a fluid that never wants to become a steam. So we never have that high pressure system. So your car, it gets a radiator gets overheated, you spring a leak, all of a sudden that antifreeze, the water in there, flashes to steam and moves in the atmosphere. If you have a molten salt and you take the lid off the pot, there's no steam. There's no phase transition to a gas until you get to crazy high temperatures. And so it never happens. And so that's why molten salt is so much better, is that it can operate at high temperatures, which gives us efficiencies, but low pressure, which gives us safety and decreased cost and things like that.
Were you originally a part of this concept, or has molten salt been around a lot longer?
Molten salt's not a new idea. So in the earliest days of reactor designs, people thought, you know, what are the right coolants that are out there? And in the 50s, the idea was put out there. In the 1960s, Oak Ridge National Lab built the molten salt reactor experiment. It operated from 1965 to 1969, and it was a molten salt cooled reactor. So the technology is not new.
And isn't there one being built today other than yours, or is yours the first?
So there's reports out of China that they're working on it. There's some reports that say that it's operational, but China really is not sharing its information with the world community. And so in the sort of free world, there's not another reactor that's designed There's a lot of designs floating around. There's not a reactor design under review by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that uses water, uses molten salt instead of water as the coolant and liquid fuel, other than our project.
Interesting. You know, we'll talk a lot about it, but the project partners are really interesting, as well as three universities, I guess, right? Talk about the team, the partners, and kind of how you've come together to be the right project partners for this project.
You bet. So Abilene Christian University stood up the NEXT Lab, Nuclear Energy Experimental Testing Lab, here several years ago with a goal of developing the technology of molten salt reactors to bless the world while we educate our students. And so that's a pretty typical research lab at a university. As we made progress and other people heard about what we were doing, Natura Resources came online as a sponsor, so an industry sponsor to support the work. And when we decided we wanted to build a research reactor at ACU, we also decided we needed to grow our research team. So we created our Research Alliance, or NEXT Research Alliance, NEXTRA, which includes the University of Texas, Texas A&M, and Georgia Institute of Technology. So four universities and Natura Resources formed together to form this research alliance, which are working together to design, license, build this research reactor.
And ultimately, where will the reactor be located?
A reactor we built on the Abilene Christian University campus. The building to house it is actually under construction now. It will be finished later this year. And the construction permit is under review by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission now. And so we're really moving forward with both the regulatory licensing and the building that will house it.
And is this classified as a small modular reactor? Or that's even when you go to a commercial scale, is this in the category of small modular reactors, or is it a giant plant?
No, this technology generically is very, very scalable. And Natura's vision is, let's demonstrate we can get a license. Let's make sure we understand what the cost of a reactor are and vendors for supplies. And then let's take this commercial. And so that's exactly why Natura is supporting the project at a university, is because there's a desire to take this technology commercial. And so, yes, this is certainly in the category of small modular reactors. The idea you could build this in a factory, ship it out on the back of a truck, install it quickly in a remote site, and have rapid deployment of nuclear technology. That's exactly what we're talking about here.
And tell us about how your application is going with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I take it it's going swimmingly well, right?
It is. So right now the NRC has two advanced reactors under review. So Kairos Power and this ACU's application are the two that are being reviewed. We asked for a rapid review process, and the NRC gave us an 18-month review period. And so we expect by May of 2024 to have our construction permit in hand. We are multiple conversations a week, back and forth in dialogue, answering questions about our application and clarifying things for them so they can do an appropriate safety evaluation on the design.
Yeah, this reactor still uses uranium and still has spent uranium as a byproduct. But I guess, is that different than a typical nuclear reactor?
So we will be fueling this reactor with uranium. Some enriched uranium is what will be the fuel for this molten salt research reactor we're building at ACU. The technology broadly allows a variety of different fuel forms. So as we go forward, and as Natura thinks about future commercial deployment, there's a lot of opportunities there to consider different fuel forms. One thing I would sort of discuss with you is this idea of spent uranium fuel. When uranium is used to power a nuclear reactor, uranium atom fissions, right? You either have uranium or you don't, right? And so when current nuclear power plants talk about spent nuclear fuel, what they're talking about is their limitation. If they use solid fuel rods, they can't get all the energy content out. And so they take out a small percentage of the energy content, but a lot of the energy content that's still stored in the nucleus of the fuel inside that fuel rod, they don't get out. But they set the fuel rod aside because it no longer can support the reactor as fuel. So you have this spent nuclear waste that is mostly fuel that hasn't been used. And that's what we've been doing for our about 100 commercial reactors for the last 50 years. You burn a few percent of the fuel, the uranium, and then the rest of it you set aside and call it spent nuclear waste because it can't support the reactor as designed in its current form. And because the United States doesn't reprocess fuel, it just goes in the waste stream. You can almost think of it as not recycling your aluminum cans, right? Your options are recycle them or throw them in the waste stream. The downside is it now has not only unused uranium, but it also has transuranics and other things that are radioactive. So now we have this spent nuclear fuel that is radioactive and it has isotopes that will last 100,000 years or something. So we have this long-term waste problem. With a liquid-fueled molten salt cooled reactor, we basically use up all the uranium, and any uranium we don't use when the reactor is decommissioned can be pulled out of the molten salt and put into the next reactor. So you don't put any fuel into your waste stream. And so you decrease the waste and increase your fuel utilization. So that's one of the exciting things about this technology. If you use a solid fuel form, uranium inside of a cladding, inside of a fuel pellet, inside of a fuel rod, you can't use all the uranium. You just use a fraction of it. If you take your fuel and you dissolve it in the molten salt, kind of like sugar and you're dissolving your coffee, so it's distributed throughout, as you burn it, you just shake in a little bit more, uranium. And so you're continuously adding slowly so you don't have to shut down for refueling or something like that. And you burn all of it, any that's left in the core, you can actually take out of the salt and put in the next reactor. So zero of it goes in the waste stream. So you really, really
decrease. This sounds like such an improvement over what we'll call traditional nuclear. And I understand if you're a nuclear physicist like you are, that's no such thing as traditional. We've had a continuum of improvements. But it sounds almost like the perfect form of nuclear energy.
Absolutely. And I think you're exactly right. One of the challenges you have with telling the story is it sounds too good to be true, right? And that's, I always joke with people that I'm talking to is that's how I know you're paying attention. Because if I get this point of the story and you're like, this sounds too good to be true, you're not really paying attention. So clearly you're paying
attention. I feel that way about propane school buses sometimes, that there's just no downside to it. So it's interesting. Well, let's talk about it. Because as I was studying this and studying you, you really give a couple talks I could see where you're really talking about, even how shocked you are sometimes to public opposition to, at least in America, 35%, I think was the number you had or so, of people fear nuclear power, when in fact nuclear power has never harmed anyone in the U.S. And that's a shocking statistic. But let's start at a very local level for a moment. You're going to put this on the campus of Abilene Christian, right?
Yeah. Yes.
How do the students feel about it?
So it's interesting. I think that as a nation or even some international surveys, I would say the population opinion on nuclear is shifting. And I assume that would be mirrored here also locally with our student body. As I've had opportunity to talk to individual groups of students, I start my conversation with what's your opinion. We have a dialogue, 30 minutes, an hour. And at the end, I re-poll. And these are informal, hands in the air type of poll. But it's amazing how quick people come to understand the differences, right? I mean, and can, once they're informed, they can make really a great decision. And so part of it is it takes a little bit longer than a sound bite. So, in our 30-minute podcast, we're going to have a chance to dialogue and talk about this. And if you're if you're limited to a sound bite, it's really hard to go into the explanation. Why is a molten salt reactor walk away safe, whereas water-cooled reactors, you know, can have accidents like Three Mile Island or Fukushima? Again, both those accidents, no one died in either of those accidents from the radiation or the reactor exposure. There was, you know, people died in the evacuation around Fukushima. There was tens of thousands of people died in the tsunami there. We don't even talk about that anymore, you know, a decade later, but we're still talking about the reactor accident that actually didn't kill a soul. And so there is some informing that needs to happen. That takes a dialogue that's a little bit longer than a sound bite. But I think when people hear that, they understand the values.
You think, so the students kind of can get it. I think the residents in and around Abilene Christian will begin to get it. Do you think the public in general will be able to understand this story?
Of course. I mean, I think the public can obviously be educated, and I think there's lots of areas where you can point to and say that, you know, common sense rules. Obviously we need to make sure people get good information. And so when there's fear mongering or, you know, whatever, there's always easy to claim the sky's falling. But this is not, you mentioned it's not a new industry. I agree with you. This is an industry that's been around and has an extremely great safety record in really the Western world. That it's been used, hundreds and hundreds of reactors for decades and decades and decades, and just the extreme safety record there. Obviously, with any large activity, there's a certain amount of accidents. I was witnessed an accident of a wind mill going down the interstate near my home where it rolled off of a shipping truck, the large parts. And so, there's hazards, whether it's wind energy or nuclear power or propane, there's hazards. We have to understand those hazards and be able to do some risk analysis. We drive our cars. That's one of the most dangerous things we could possibly do. But the hazards are related to nuclear power. We have decades of experience of doing it very safely. But we can even do it better. And that's the exciting thing to me.
Let's even go a little further, because I'm always shocked at people who, one, I mean, there is a body of people who kind of want to live in huts and go to bed when the sun goes down and wake up. And I have to push them off to the side. But there are other people who love their cell phones, really believe in their electric car, but have no interest in any form of power other than that from solar and wind. And I'll just speak for me, started, I'm going to ask you, as we study the energy complex, we don't see a world that really gets us to where we want to go without significant nuclear, not just nuclear, but significant amounts of nuclear. Do you see it any differently than that?
No, I think that, again, is when you start looking at the options that are there and you say, you know, what do we as a, you know, what, and it doesn't really matter what you're saying, city, state, country or globe. What do we value? Do we like the idea of sitting in the dark and freezing to death? No, we're not going to do that. We can look to Germany and say, what did they do this last winter when their energy supply was threatened? What did they do? They bulldozed windmills and strip mined coal from beautiful countryside to ensure that they didn't sit in the dark and freeze to death. Okay, if we're not going to sit in the dark and freeze to death, what are our other options? Well, certainly when the wind's blowing, the sun's shining, we have other options. But if we're talking about dispatchable, reliable, or on-demand energy, what are our options? Propane, fossil fuels of all sorts, or nuclear. And the only one of those, the only one of those sources that we've talked about that is both, you know, carbon-free and dispatchable is nuclear. And so
I might add one other piece that I think that also has relatively small land use per gigawatt output. I mean, I think, again, the statement I often use is, if we filled Connecticut with solar and we filled West Virginia with wind and we filled Rhode Island with batteries, we could, in fact, power Dallas, right? This energy density isn't really appropriate, but energy density for nuclear is significantly better. For that matter, energy density for combined cycle gas plants. But, you know, the Wall Street Journal ran an article this week, Washington Post last week, really beginning to talk about, you know, a few realities of this energy transformation. They were really pushing back or highlighting rural America, saying enough. I don't want to surrender my farm, you know, to solar panels. Can you see these kinds of technologies, specifically molten salt reactors? Can you see this technology kind of coming in closer to the urban environments and being accepted?
Again, small modular reactor, you mentioned that earlier, that they can be deployed as small modular reactors. They are walkaway safe. So what that means is, yes, you can bring them right into where they're needed. And so we don't need to have the huge investment in transmission lines running across the country from, you know, wherever your energy source is to wherever the need is. You can bring these power supplies right next to the, whether it's the industry applications or the, you know, consumer homes. But that's the idea, is that you can distribute the power supply. We no longer have to have these huge gigawatt scale power plants that are, you know, again, with a high voltage transmission lines strung across the nation.
Rusty, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
We're back with Dr. Rusty Tao, physics professor at Abilene Christian University, the director of the NEXT Lab, and we're talking about molten salt nuclear reactors. I would encourage all of our listeners to go to your TED Talk, Why Making Energy from Dirt Might Save the World. I mean, I thought it was, you know, brilliant. But there you're clear to put Chernobyl into a class by itself. I think, to quote you, really a nuclear bomb making plant that tried to make nuclear power for the community. And it's to quote you, I think that's a terrible idea. Fukushima, a bit different. Three Mile Island, quite a bit different. But the safety aspect here, the key is, in fact, the molten salt, right? Molten salt's not going to really run away, if you will. And you talk a lot about the frozen plug at the bottom, that if you had a problem, the frozen plug would melt, you'd lose your salt, and you're shut down, right? The key to this is its safety devices.
That's right. And one of the things you said earlier that just to circle back to and not disagree, but maybe clarify, you said this, you know, this is an evolving industry that's had 50 years of evolution. And really, the technology largely that we have deployed in our, you know, 93 power plants, plus the two that are coming online in Georgia, is this pressurized water reactor. It's almost the same technology that we had 50 or 60 years ago. And so can we do better? Absolutely. Let's replace the water with molten salt. That makes it, you know, as you say, walk away safe. You know, you can drain the fuel with this design. You can drain the fuel from the reactor, and it's in a subcritical situation. And as it cools off, the salt becomes a solid. And so you have in a drain tank, you have all of your fuel encased in a solid slug of salt. It's safe. It's shut down. There's not no action that has to be taken, no emergency backup power or coolant that has to happen. And if there's a failure, then you end up with a disaster. That's not the case for these reactors.
Let's talk about a couple of things that have happened in the world of nuclear. And I am quick to say that I think, as you have just said earlier, I think the tide is turning a bit now in favor of nuclear. And we've had a couple of high profile developments. One, I guess Georgia Power, I tend to call it Southern Company. I'm not sure exactly. I guess Georgia Power is the operator, but the Vogtle plant is online, right? Or it's near to be online. Did you really believe that would happen?
Well, I've certainly been watching it, and I think a lot of the world's watching it because, you know, unfortunately, I think the word nuclear spans the industry. And so whether it's new nuclear, old nuclear, U.S. nuclear, Russian nuclear, et cetera, people see it as all the same thing, right? I mean, we certainly don't do this with anything else, right? I mean, we understand the difference between different models and makes of cars, right? And we don't say that a Russian tank is the same thing as a Chevy sports car, right? I mean, they're all cars or all vehicles, but they're very different. Nuclear sort of gets put under that umbrella. And so the ability to go in and have the subtle differences and say, you know, what we're building and what we're proposing is totally different than what has been done or will be done is absolutely there. So going back to your question about the Georgia Power, been watching and looking at it, very thankful and excited they came online. What does it do to the industry when you say, yes, it's the first one in decades and it came in at, you know, years and years late and billions of dollars over budget? Do they look at the technology we're developing and say, should I invest in this? Should the nation put our hope in a nuclear future if it's always late and overpriced? Well, big projects, first of a kind, you sort of understand that. And I think you have to give some grace, but there must be a path to streamlining production. And so, yes, I believe that the technology we're building will let us drive the cost down while we drive the safety up. Excited for Georgia. Did I think it would happen or not? I guess I assumed it would once they're, you know, $15 billion in, even if there's another $100 million in that, it's, you know, it seems like a wise investment. So I think I assumed it would happen.
There were days I wondered. All right. And then just this week, Microsoft announced purchase of Fusion Power, I think maybe 50 gigawatts by 2028.
I love fusion. I think that's an amazing energy source. It obviously powers our sun and it's been shining for billions of years. And so we have an amazing energy source there. You know, when you're getting energy out of the strong force, whether it's fission or fusion, it's the energy density is there, as you mentioned earlier. So fusion is an amazing energy source. It's worth studying. It has never been developed. It has never been demonstrated that there's a commercially viable path to getting energy out of it. So until there's a demonstration plant, the idea that someone can come in and buy that energy in 5 years is sort of shocking to me. And that I don't believe will happen. I think my favorite quote about fusion that people have been saying for decades is, you know, fusion power is 40 years away, and always will be, or has been for 40 years. I don't think we're going to get there this decade.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I studied their, you know, the recent success with fusion, which was really, I mean, it was the first quarter step in a 1,000-mile journey, and to move from that, and I'd seen, I don't know, $1.5 billion of investment has kind of been made into fusion, I think, in the last 12 months. But to see that press announcement was actually astonishing, because as you would say, I would be one that says if we were going to produce fusion energy in 5 years, that plant is already fully under design, permitting, and construction. So events like that just make you wonder sometimes about the accuracy of the storytelling around this transition. So let me throw you a softball there, maybe. Look ahead 2045, 2050. What does the world look like for nuclear energy? I mean, we live in a place today where South Korea is fairly invested in it. I guess France fairly invested in it. The US certainly been a leader in that. GE, Hitachi, our own plant here in Lynchburg, Virginia. But what does the world look like with nuclear in 2050?
Nuclear is the primary energy source used by the globe. So worldwide, nuclear by 2050 will be the energy source that's used, whether it's large shipping containers or providing electricity or providing high process heat to industry. It'll be the number one source of energy around the globe. That's what I believe.
And will there be centers of excellence, or do you think it'll be all over the world distributed? I mean, again, developing versus developed, maybe, but.
That's a great question. And I think that obviously there'll still be centers of excellence and centers of innovation. And, you know, and hopefully, you know, the U.S. can sort of maintain its leadership there. But I think that, you know, if you're a developing nation, and you want to help people lift themselves out of poverty, right? The way to do that is provide them with, you know, clean, safe, affordable energy, and that raises people's standards of living. And so if you're a developing nation, would you invest, hundreds of millions of dollars in a coal power plant and have to have a continuous supply of coal? Or would you invest in, you know, solar panels that have a short lifetime and a high cost? Or do you invest in nuclear power, which has small footprint, of minimal impact on the environment, extremely proven safety record, and small modular reactors? You can just buy it from a reactor vendor and install a walk-away safe reactor. They're going to invest in nuclear. So I believe nuclear will be used around the globe. By 2050, it'll be in all nations, I believe. And so, again, centers of excellence will be there. Nations that naturally have lots of hydrothermal power, they're not going to get rid of that. They're not going to blow up their dams. They'll continue using that. But where it makes sense to have other forms, I think there'll be a smattering. But the idea that we're going to be wind, solar, battery by 2050 is also sort of absurd.
Yeah, it's just so interesting to me. And again, you're a Texan, you're a physicist, so I would expect some of that rational thinking. But you know, this as you study it, and you actually study it in a quantitative way, so not just theoretical. You look at how many watts, gigawatts, terawatts, whatever, however you want to define it, we need the growth rates. Then you bring on developing, you know, nations. You got to believe China moves forward, and you got to believe all of Africa moves forward, and huge swaths of Asia that have not yet developed, and you give them the opportunity to develop as well. The only thing that makes it work in a lower carbon energy world is nuclear. And I don't know why everyone sees it. And to your points, often you can design the safety systems quite effective, certainly quite effective compared to anything else, right? Nothing's unsafe. All right, I want to start closing, but I want to give you a chance, because again, studying you, I found a portion of your talk fascinating, as you really brought energy, medicine, and water into perfect view. Just as briefly as you can, share with our listeners kind of this nexus of medicine, energy, and water.
So when we started to stand up the Next Lab here at Abilene Christian University, what we looked at, you know, what is the mission of this lab? And the mission of the lab is to provide global solutions for the world's need for energy, water, and medical isotopes by advancing technology in molten salt reactors while educating future leaders in nuclear science engineering. That aligns with the university mission of creating Christian servant leaders throughout the world. And so this was a how we live into that mission as scientists, as engineers. And that's really just as we studied what you could get out of a molten salt reactor. These are the byproducts. So obviously we can get energy that is safe and clean and affordable. And with that, you can change people's lives, as we already mentioned. We energy raises the standard of living of people. But with this new technology of not having solid fuel rods, that you actually, the medical isotopes are generated in the reactor actually have the possibility of getting them, you know, out of the reactor and into doctors' hands. And so whether they're isotopes for diagnostic uses like molybdenum-99 that's used 50 million times a year in the U.S., but virtually none of it is produced in the U.S., or whether you're talking about, more excitedly, medical isotopes to treat cancer. Targeted alpha therapy is a very powerful tool that doctors use, but you need isotopes that are alpha emitters. And right now they're produced in the core of reactors and the core of stars, basically. And until we have the ability of getting isotopes produced in a reactor into doctors' hands in the course of days or hours before those isotopes decay, they don't have this tool. So, and then the last thing is high process heat. Well, the industry has lots of uses for it, but desalinating water is something that really is a need around the world. So these three needs: medical isotopes, water, and energy that can, you know, raise people out of poverty. Those are things that are really going to make the world a better place. And that's what's exciting to me and those working on this project, is we're doing something that's going to make the world a better place.
Really fascinating to me. And thank you for sharing that. All right, Rusty, we're going to hand you a magic wand, and you use that magic wand to change one thing in the next year that you think would have the biggest impact on the energy transformation, maybe climate change. How would you use that wand?
Well, I would just like, and this, maybe this is a cheat answer, but I would like to have the everyone appreciate the vision and understand the goal here. And so, you know, maybe it's a moonshot type of thing, but, you know, whether it's government regulators, whether it's investors, whether it's vendors of individual subsystems, I'd love all of those parties to buy into, let's work together to make the world a better place. We can have improved advanced nuclear. We can deploy it small modular reactor rapidly. It's going to take all the above to get there. We have to improve our regulatory process. NRC is already working on that. We have to have new investments. There's actually a lot of investment coming in, but we'll need more. If by 2050, nuclear power is the dominant source of power around the globe to make safe, clean, affordable power in an environmental friendly way without producing waste, it's going to need buy-in by lots more investors and supply chains, et cetera. So I'd love to see everyone see that vision of a better tomorrow and work to help us get there.
What a great use of your magic wand. And I think we could all support you in that, you know, particularly those of us who just study this transformation and don't see it happening either on time or even happening without a significant improvement from the nuclear industry. We'd love to thank our guests for appearing on Path to Zero by having a tree planted in a national forest in your honor, in your name, kind of reflect your time being here. Now, you're in Texas, and we've been into the Davy Crockett National Forest. We've been into the Sabine National Forest, but those are just a few. Have you got a favorite place that you would have us plant a tree in your name?
Any of those Texas National Forests would be great. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of National Forests in West Texas. We're a little drier climate, so they're all over in East Texas, but any one of those would be super. Thank you.
Well, that's great. We'll look forward to doing that. Dr. Tao, you have been a fascinating guest. Thanks so much for being with us today on Path to Zero.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you've learned something from our conversation with Dr. Rusty Tao. And we always welcome your suggestions on who to invite on the show. Reach out to us with suggestions or questions or comments at pathtozero@propane.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.